House Interim Committee on Business and Labor. And welcome, everyone. Thank you for taking your time out of your busy schedule. It's an awfully nice day out there. I didn't expect that. So I'm just going to open up an informational meeting throughout these four issues and call up good Commissioner Brad Avakian from Bureau of Labor and Industries. Welcome, Brad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for inviting us here today. I'll do a couple things here. I have Amy Clare, the administrator of our Civil Rights Division, with me, who's sitting right in back, and she'll give you some more information about the Civil Rights Division in particular. And I understand that the committee would like to have a brief overview of the Bureau of Labor, and I can do that, give you some statistics, and that the committee also wanted an update on the New Oregon Council on Civil Rights, which I'm happy to do, and then an update from the Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee. Does that cover it pretty good, Mr. Chair?
That's perfect. Thank you.
All right, good. Let me start by just giving you, I suppose I need for the record, Brad Avakian, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Let me give you a brief overview of the functions of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. It's an agency that's got varied and strong powers in a number of areas, but we do primarily four different things. We have the state's Apprenticeship Training Division, which you know has a large hand in the state's workforce development system by certifying and then making sure that all of the apprenticeship training facilities in the state, and then making sure that they continue to abide by certain standards so they're graduating good skilled workers. We have the state's wage and hour division. We enforce all of the state's wage and hours, including meal and rest periods. It's also the division that that sets the prevailing wages for the state of Oregon. We have the state's technical assistance program. This is the agency's face to Oregon's employers. This is the unit that when an employer needs help navigating their way through the complicated state and federal employment laws, they can call our hotline at the technical assistance unit for free in order to get help. We also do about 220 seminars in all four corners of the state. We'll even go to an individual employer's business if they ask us to, in order to do a tailored training for that business. For instance, if a business wants to train its managers in family leave law, we can send a team down there in order to do that. In the last legislative session, the legislature helped us out and Oregon's employers tremendously by giving some general fund money back to that division. About a decade ago, the general fund money was zeroed out of the technical assistance division, which meant that the only reason it has even survived the last decade is by charging employers for these seminars and programs. You funded part of the division last time, which puts us on a great step to eventually decreasing or eliminating those fees for Oregon's employers. So thank you very much for that. The fourth area is our Civil Rights Division. We are the state's chief law enforcement agency protecting people's civil rights, not only on the job. We also do all of the state and federal housing discrimination complaints, and we also investigate all complaints of discrimination in public places. So in restaurants and public parks and bowling alleys and theaters, we handle those complaints as well. To give you an idea of how that works within the agency, and Amy Clare will come up and give you some more specifics, but we have investigators, case presenters are like prosecutors, a judge, and then I make the ultimate decision on all civil rights cases, all within the Bureau of Labor and Industry. So it can be a very strong but also a very efficient process for protecting people's rights. Now, just to give you a few stats with regard to what the Bureau does, our Civil Rights Division last year received about 32,000 calls from Oregonians with questions about their civil rights. We investigated over 2,200 formal complaints of discrimination. The wage and hour division, in addition to that, received about 25,000 phone calls from individuals with wage and hour questions, and we investigated approximately 2,600 wage and hour claims. You lump onto that the fact that we got about another 25,000 calls from Oregon employers through the Technical Assistance Unit with questions about how to accommodate and work with their employees. You're looking at a huge workload, which we welcome, but a huge workload from both businesses and individuals with questions about their rights on the job, in housing, and in all public places. In the fiscal years 2008 and 2009, we put about $2 million in the pockets of individuals who had been discriminated against through through settlements with the wrongdoers. In wage and hour, almost $5 million in wages that were due but not paid. We collected and got to employees who were entitled to the money, so you're looking at about $7 million combined for Oregon workers that were entitled to compensation that had not been compensated. Let me talk for a minute about the Oregon Council on Civil Rights. Unique responsibilities of the labor commissioner is similar to what you think of as the boards and commissions that the governor can appoint, is that statutorily the labor commissioner can create councils and agencies. A decade ago, Oregon had a council on human and civil rights that fell by the wayside, I think to the great detriment of Oregonians. And so in the last year, I created the Oregon Council on Civil Rights. It's a 25-member council from all four corners of the state, from differing races and faiths and cultural backgrounds. And the job of the Council on Civil Rights will be twofold. One will be to advise me, the Civil Rights Division, the legislature and the governor, if you ask for the assistance from them on all matters related to civil rights in the state. Second, they will create a vision and an action plan for civil rights issues in the state. They've met twice, so they still are in that process of organizing and creating a method by which they're going to create this vision for the state. I did want to let you in on one thing they will be working on that I have asked them to do, and that is equal pay for equal work. Oregon right now is 25th in the nation in the disparity between the wages that women earn and the wages that white men earn. Women in Oregon still earn 80 cents on the dollar compared to their white male counterparts. If you are a minority man, you earn less than 70 cents on the dollar compared to your white male counterpart. And if you are a minority woman, you earn even less than that with respect to white male counterparts on the job. I think it's a shameful place for Oregon to be. No state, and the federal government as well, has created an effective action plan for closing those historical gaps. And so what I have asked the Council on Civil Rights to do is create an action plan that won't just close, but that will eliminate the gaps in inequity between minorities and women and white men. Let me give you an update on prevailing wage as well. One of the functions of the labor commissioner and is to set the prevailing wages for the state. And I want to briefly describe for you how that system internally works so that you can see why I have asked the Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee to do something. Twice a year, the Employment Department, working with the Bureau of Labor, sends out a survey to contractors around the state. And what the contractors do is they fill out in this survey how many union hours they had work on their jobs and how many non-union hours they had work on their jobs. That's important because if a region is more than, a trade in a region has more than 50% union hours, then that trade prevails in that region. So we have to figure out how many union versus non-union hours will work. The second part to the survey then says, well, how much did you pay these folks? Because what we're trying to do in the 14 regions around the state is figure out, one, whether the majority of hours worked was union or non-union, and then second, what it was in that geographical region that was the predominant rate of pay. And I take that information when it comes back and make determinations. Now, it's a lot of information. It's a lot in 14 different regions, over 4,000 contractors that get surveyed. The employment department gets this data. It goes into notebooks that our office creates, and I end up twice a year with a stack of notebooks from here to the ceiling on all of this data, and we go through every single trade of every single region, and I make over 400 determinations on how much contractors have to pay and how much workers are going to be paid. Now, my experience in going through that the first time was that the system was making a good attempt to try and find out those various factors, union versus non-union hours, and what the wage was. The difficulty that I saw in the system was that not everybody sends the survey back. Now, I can go after them and penalize them for not doing it, but that doesn't mean that I actually get the information that I need. The other is there's no check and balance in the system for me to know whether what I'm getting is accurate, which is by no means implying that somebody is frauding the system, but just that there is no check and balance to know whether it's accurate information, whether mistakes are made, or whether there's somebody who intentionally doesn't give the right information. Knowing that, there really was no way for me to know whether the data I was using was statistically valid or reliable. So, I asked the Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee, which is a committee that exists in order to advise the Labor Commissioner and the Bureau of Labor on issues related to prevailing wage, to go back to the survey and analyze it from beginning to end and come up with recommendations for me on what would create a fairer and hopefully an easier system that I could use for determinations. I think you have before you, or if you don't, will shortly, a letter which is only preliminary. These are not conclusions yet. A letter from the Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee coming up with 9 different recommendations on how to improve the system. I'm not going to go through each one of them. You can ask me questions if you have about any one of them, but I'll highlight a couple of those that I think are important. One of the changes they're recommending, which is going to be the most difficult one to do, but it's important, is to delete something called peak week reporting. If we asked every contractor to give us all their data for every job for every week of the year, it would be an unmanageable amount of data given the staff, the employment department, and we have. So the way it works is we have them pick what in essence was their biggest week and their most active week, and they give us that data. It's called peak week. The benefit to that is it decreases the amount of data, makes it a manageable system. The downside to it is we may not really be getting reliable information on how much people are really getting paid out there in various regions around the state by only focusing on 1 week's worth of work. So the committee has come back and suggested that we report all hours throughout the year. And we're sorting through whether or not that can be done or not. The other is to use an option, at least, for a web-based reporting format, so it's not all done by paper mailing back and forth. Another recommendation was to not send the wage survey to temporary labor agencies because temporary labor doesn't really accurately represent what might be going on in an entire region. Another is to establish an audit system where we do random checks to make sure that the information we're getting in the surveys is accurate. And then there were a number of changes related to the survey form itself, just to make it easier to read and fill out, decrease the burden on contractors. Where we're at process-wise is by the end of the month of this month, the Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee will have finished all of their meetings, discussions, hearings on the matter, and they'll finalize recommendations that will come to me. The Employment Department is meeting this month and coming up with their own list of things that they think could be changed to improve the survey. And I will, after that, receive both their reports and be making some decisions in consultation with all of you and others as to what changes we will actually be implementing in the next year. The last thing I want to say about prevailing wage, and then I will stop for questions, is because we were engaged in this process of evaluating the system, and because I wasn't convinced that sending out a survey right now would get me any better information than I have received in other surveys, I suspended sending out the mid-year survey and instead continued the determinations that I had made last January, that were in effect last January. What I am hoping is that after we get these results back in December from the Employment Department and the Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee, that I can propose new changes early next year and have a new survey out during the first quarter of next year and make determinations again, hopefully by March or April. Mr. Chair, I will end there, and before Amy Clare comes up, see if the committee has any questions.
I just have a few comments. Commissioner, thanks for coming too, by the way. And first of all, your department it just lacks funding, period. I mean, I was on the subcommittee. It looked at your budget. It's just criminal what we've done to Boley in this state over the years, and it has a direct negative impact on workers and, quite frankly, to business in Oregon, helping them comply with the law and your technical assistance with them. So that's one thing I think we need to really bang the drum around here in 11 as far as getting better funding for your department. On the civil rights, I'm on the governor's task force on disproportionality in the child welfare system, and it's a rather large group of folks, needless to say, very diverse, and one of the subcommittees that we've chosen to create is the very disproportionality you spoke of in the workplace. So I'm going to, obviously, I'm confident we'll work together, and you bring on all kinds of information to share with us, and I'm sure we can team up to work on something together. It's a good group of folks. And then I hope there's some kind of software or some kind of data gathering mechanism for contractors so they don't have to send reams of paperwork, and you could just have a computer analyze this and make it a lot more user-friendly, less labor-intensive, because we have to maintain these records anyway if you're a contractor. And I can't believe in this day and age we can't figure out a system that would analyze things very quickly and determine whether or not things are accurate and according to Hoyle, and that's something I'm very interested in as well. And then lastly, as I said out in the hall, I've heard a lot of anecdotal stories about prevailing wage or the lack of determination of prevailing a job on these solar retrofit jobs on public buildings, specifically Multnomah County School District up Portland Way. I have not got any specific numbers that say there is a problem, but I just wanted to share that with you. If you want to talk about that or any of these, or move on to Amy, it's up to you. And then, but before we go on to Amy, I want to open up questions to these good people too.
Well, let me thank you, Mr. Chair. With respect to the last issue you brought up, I think there have been discussions from a number of sources about how we handle, we as a state handle, certain prevailing wage determinations with the installation of solar panels now. And It does bring up some unique situations that are not solely related to solar panels. What you will there are regulations that guide us in how we determine what prevails and what doesn't prevail. It has to do with how much money the government is putting into a project and whether or not the government's going to make use of the project and this type of a thing. Privately owned and built structures don't prevail. What we see happening anecdotally is you will sometimes have a government entity have an agreement with a private entity that the private entity will buy all the materials with private money, insure it with private money, build it with private money, own it privately until it's done, and then gift it to the government. And in that manner, avoid paying prevailing wages on a project that otherwise might have prevailed. And situations similar to that have come up with the installation of solar panels on government buildings. And under the current law, the way I just described it, could end up in a situation where the project doesn't prevail. So it's an issue that I think we should be talking about, and certainly if there are any legislators that have any bills pending, share them with us so that we can be partners in building a fair system.
Thank you. Any questions of the good commissioner? Representative Holby.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, thanks a lot for all your work in this. I know it's a tough job, and trying to wade through the morass of issues that you deal with. And I appreciate our conversations that we've had. I have a couple question, perhaps, Mr. Chair. Just on the prevailing wage advisory committee issue, I was curious whether or not the advisory committee or you have thought about the accuracy of the reporting and how you would follow up to make sure the hours were being reported in the correct region by the contractors, and how you would be able to track that.
Currently and historically, there has not been a check to that. One of the recommendations from the advisory committee is to create an audit system so that we could, every time we do a survey, randomly choose contractors and audit their information in order to, it would be like an investigation, a friendly investigation, to make sure the information was accurate. And with 4,000 or so contractors, you'd have to do a random type of an audit. But the audit is where we're heading in order to, and to build an audit system that was statistically valid so that you could rely on the fact that you had a secure system. That's where we're heading.
And a follow-up question, Mr. Vice Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. And another question was much simpler for you, probably, in the survey, perhaps. Is there a distinction that you're able to disseminate from those surveys that that would, I guess, differentiate between a residential tradesperson and a commercial tradesperson in these surveys?
Mr. Chair and Representative Holby, there is a breaking down between types of construction, heavy highway construction, and other types of commercial construction. Residential construction shouldn't be included, but there is not, like I say, an audit system in place now to verify that that's what the data is representing.
Thank you. Okay. Your answer is
okay. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Commissioner, for being here, and I do appreciate the things your office do, and there's some good suggestions here. I'm just trying to get my head around how these prevailing wages are determined, and you did go through it, so I'm just wanting to make sure I understand it, because I was distracted a little bit up here. However, so bear with me. So you separate hours into union hours versus non-union hours. I'm trying to understand what's to be done with that, because a lot of contractors are subject to paying prevailing wage that aren't union, and then there's, I'm just trying to understand what that does.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, it would have been helpful if I brought you a sheet. I'll do that next time we do this, to show you what exactly the data sheet looks like. It's helpful to see, but I think I can describe it well. The data gets boiled down into sheets that will look something like this. A sheet for plumbers, and then broken down into the 14 different regions for the state. And under Region 1, it will tell me how many contractors reported, how many plumbers worked for that peak week period in Region 1, how many union hours were reported, how many non-union hours were reported. It's all self-report by the contractors. Mm-hmm. And then it'll tell me what the wage was that was reported by the contractors. So I open my notebook, flip to the plumbers page when it's time to make their determination, and I look to Region 1, and I look first to see whether or not there was more than 50% union work. Because by law, if there was not, then I don't prevail that region. But so let's say there was more than 50% union work in that region. If there was, then I prevail that region. Once it's prevailed, the prevailing wage applies to all the work that's done there. So if you're a non-union contractor using non-union work, the prevailing wage is still the wage that prevailed in that region, and that's what you pay. Where it gets a little trickier is if it's less than 50% and I don't prevail it, then what we do is we try and find what the state average was, what the average wage was in the particular region, and then that's the wage that I can impose, a statewide average. And then you flip the page to the carpenters, and you move on with them, and you go through every single trade for every single region like that.
Okay, and now just to follow up with it. The carpenters, a lot of them will work on residential or just private work, and then a lot of them are working on projects that are already subject to prevailing wage. So the report that you would get back from these people already have the prevailing wage there, and then you have maybe a different wage over here in the totally private work where it's not, you know, dictated what you pay other than, you know, above minimum and whatever market says. So I'm just wondering, how do you differentiate any of that, or is there, I mean, if you're only getting reports back from mostly people who already are subject to paying prevailing wage, it just seems like it might affect your outcome. I'm just wondering if there's any data that, I don't know how to say this, that keeps track of that, I guess. Is there any way of keeping track of who, okay, you've got reports from people, but these numbers reflect people who are contractors who already are subject to prevailing wage on most of their work versus this contractor who is not subject to prevailing wage on most of their work.
Yeah, thank you for that question, Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher. I think I understand where you're headed with that. There are some regions and some trades that historically prevail all the time, and it's because one of the biggest factors is because most of the work being done is done by huge contractors that always use union labor. And so year to year, you don't see the results change much. But there are some other areas, mostly when you start getting outside the Willamette Valley towards the rural parts of the state, where that isn't always the case. And it is important to build a system that helps contractors easily differentiate between the kind of commercial and residential work they're doing in the union versus non-union, because in those regions, you really might be very close. You might be at 48 or 51% union versus non-union labor, so the information is very important to have accurately, as opposed to in downtown Portland, where you might have 80% union labor all the time. And so we're trying to build a system, including the audit system, that allows us to more specifically get more specific and reliable information like you're describing.
Okay. One more small question. When you're saying 50%, are you talking about hours or dollars or numbers of people?
Total number of hours worked by a particular trade in a particular region.
Okay, thank you.
I think there's one more before we go to Representative Witt. You know, we're talking about our tax dollars here, and I think that's what we need to focus on. And I'm not interested in collecting all the data on all those private contractors and private projects where they can pay whatever they want as long as it's above minimum wage. I'm never going to be interested in that. These are my tax dollars. I want my tax dollars going to living wage jobs in this state, and I can define living wage anytime anybody wants me to. So I just want to, just in case somebody's listening to this conversation, I'm going to make clear, we're talking about our tax, state and federal tax dollars here. That's what we're prevailing. And it's in that universe, if you will, we're focusing on these surveys.
It's an important point, Mr. Chair, and to say it in a slightly different way, we have to remember that everything we've discussed here applies only to public projects.
Thank you very much, Mr. Commissioner.
Not to completely private projects, which is up to whatever market dictates the cost of labor.
Representative Witt, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to comment that I thought your suggestions for funding and paper reduction at the Bureau were spot on and a good prescription for good government, and just wanted to let the Commissioner know that I intend to have a bill dealing with the solar installation on public buildings, and as soon as I have something in writing, I'll be more than happy to share it with you and your staff. And I do have a question, though, Mr. Chairman, whether that peak week served with crawfish and hot sauce or not. So,
what was?
I'm sorry.
Never mind.
I was focusing and concentrating on something very important. I missed it.
There goes a whole flock, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Cameron, then Representative.
Yeah. I just want to clarify so I understand. Commissioner, the information we're collecting, the wage information, is not specifically wages that were paid on government projects. It's on everything that contractor was doing during that period of time, whether it was a public project or a private project. It was for a plumber who may have built a building that was private as well as one that was public during that period.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, because we're trying to find out what the predominant wage is for a trade in a region, in a geographic region.
Okay.
Yes.
And then just one, thank you, follow up with me, Mr.
Please, Chair.
And then just the last thing was, we heard earlier about a company, a private company who would finance privately, build a building, and then gift it to a government agency. So all private dollars, no government dollars, but somebody giving the project to a government agency, and that there's a question as to whether that should be prevailing wage or not. Is that what I'm hearing?
Chair,
is something we're looking at?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, there's no question under the current law that it would not prevail. The policy question, I think, for all of you is because much of the prevailing theory behind prevailing wage is that when the government is going to have a building that it uses for government purposes, that we believe that you ought to pay a living, a fair living wage for the construction of the building, and that maybe what's happening out there in some situations is to avoid paying a higher wage and a prevailing wage through this process that you just repeated in having it all done privately but then given to a government later.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Matthews, forgive me, I have you on my list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a quick comment, not to do with prevailing wage, but I'd be remiss. Mr. Commissioner, I just want to thank you for your time and your efforts with the soldiers. You know, we've been talking reintegration. We're getting ready to get them back here safely in about, hopefully, 6 or 7 months. I sat with Casey Baldwin's father this morning at an assembly at a school, and we were talking about some of the good work that we've done to protect their employment when they come back and what the state's done. And I think it's important that we recognize Borley and the commissioner's leadership on that, working with our AG's office and working with this body to make sure that our soldiers come back to the jobs that they left. These are citizen soldiers. They deserve the opportunity. And thanks again, sir, for all your efforts. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, do I have 3 minutes to comment?
Absolutely. Please do.
Very timely and very important, Mr. Chair, Representative Matthews. I don't know what role the AG's office would have in job placement of people coming back, but It's a very important issue for us. And we're starting to see something that I think is very unique amongst this crop of returning vets, and I wanted to share an example with you. I have for several months now been emailing back and forth with one of our soldiers who's serving in Afghanistan, who wants to come back and, of course, have a job. He's newly married, and he's concerned about being able to find a job. And so he's got, unlike soldiers of the past, you know, he's got his cell phone, he's got his computer, he knows what's going on in Oregon right now with our high unemployment rate. They check it all the time and they talk amongst themselves. He's sending out resumes from Afghanistan, trying to line things up, and he's communicating with the Bureau of Labor saying, help me prepare now so that when I get back, I'm not scrambling for work with my family not having the kind of income we should have. And I mention it only because it provides great opportunity for our agency and other agencies that are working with vets to not just be waiting till they get back on our shores, but to actually be implementing some contacts for them now so that when they get back, there's something available. I think we're doing some good work in that regard. I also want to thank you for the good work you did last session, not just on this issue, but on another one that the Bureau has jurisdiction over, which is incredibly important, and that is the providing of some leave off to spouses of military personnel. We had, and we're not going to get these emails anymore, I don't think. We, you know, have been getting emails from spouses who oftentimes, one in particular, had a newborn at home with a husband who was being shipped off to a war zone in Afghanistan, who had requested 3 days off in order to spend with her husband and newborn before they left. Now, we are lucky in Oregon, fortunate to have, I think, tremendous employers who bend over backwards for the folks that work for them. But in this particular case, you know what happened. The time off was rejected, put this young family in the horrible position of having to choose between her going to work, keeping her job, or staying home to spend time with her husband and newborn as he leaves to a war zone. She chose to go to work because that's what their family needed. But with the new law that you passed, which very reasonably balances the needs of employers with the needs of that family, our agency is not going to have to tell those folks anymore there's no law that protects you. And that's what we'll be doing. So excellent work on your part last session.
I think the whole committee is grateful for what you're doing, Commissioner. It's stories like that that remind me that every now and then we get it right around here and we do it together. But let me see, there was one more thing. I'm just going to move on to Amy unless there's any further questions of the Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Amy Clare, the Administrator of the State Civil Rights Division.
All right, great.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and committee staff. For the record, my name is Amy Clare, and I'm the Administrator of the Civil Rights Division. And with the Chair's permission, I'd like to have Kate Newhall, our Legislative
Kate,
Director,
please
join
come on
me.
Up, Kate.
She's responsible for a big fancy handout that I can't take credit for, although it's daunting because we are responsible for enforcing all these new laws. But so thank you. I think before you, as a two, it's one sheet with, or is she handing them out? Okay. Well, you're going to be getting a list of bills from the two, between 2007 and 2009 that were passed that gave, that affects the Civil Rights Division and the jurisdiction over which types of cases we have, some of which we were speaking about, just Mr. Commissioner was just a few minutes ago with you about the military members and others. And also, I have another handout that I want to congratulate the Commissioner's executive staff for making a pretty chart that shows our new staff people, our existing and new staff people. I'll talk about that a little bit later. And you're also getting a handout that is from a presentation I gave recently to state agencies and I think it's interesting to look at. It goes over the top seven types of claims we see in the private sector and then those against state agencies. They're similar, but there are some significant differences, so I thought you might find that helpful. And for those of you who like to look at charts rather than reading all these different laws, you've got a handout that shows all the protected classes under state and federal law.
Thank you.
Which you should have shortly. The top part kind of compares the Federal Civil Rights Act of 1964 with Oregon's Chapter 659A, where most of our civil rights laws are, and they're similar. But then there's also laws that are not covered under federal law that are covered under only state law, and that'll be the bottom half of your sheet, which is dozens more. Everybody get their charts?
Yep.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Okay, so the sheet that I have starts off with a number of bills that are in a category called employment protections. And I'm not going to go through each of these. I just wanted to give you an idea of sort of the aggregate number of changes that have happened in each of these types of areas. And I'll point out a few that we've spoken about before. In 2007, the legislature enacted Senate Bill 822, which created veterans' preference in hiring for public employment. It actually strengthened an existing law, and it had a 15-year limit for when the time of service was, and that was removed. So the veterans' preference in public employment now applies, and there is no time limit from the time of service. And then the uniform protections for uniform service members from unlawful employment practices. I think we spoke about that earlier. By employers on the basis of your service commitments. That's one of our new important laws, House Bill 3256. Another significant bill that we've probably seen a lot in the press about is Senate Bill 786, which required employers to provide strengthened reasonable accommodations for religious observances. Unless providing that accommodation would impose an undue hardship on the employer. There was already an existing law prior to this about religious accommodation, but it was a de minimis standard, meaning the employer really didn't have to do much to say that they didn't have to accommodate the religious accommodation. And then the next several lists of bills are just different types of expansions on protected leave. One of the most significant ones of 2007 that redefined family leave to exclude leave taken by an employee who was unable to work due to a disabling workers' comp claim. This was Senator Rosenbaum's bill, and what she would have found from a number of her constituents is when an employee would be out on a workers' comp claim, and that would be a serious condition under OFLA, their OFLA and their workers' comp claim are running concurrently, so when the person claimed when they were ready to go back to work, they would not have any leave left for another family leave for their own health condition or a family member's health condition. So that helps people preserve their leave banks. And then there was another change that allowed employees to use their sick leave when taking family leave. Prior to that, that was only allowed for parental leave or for one's own sick time. This allows for every form of family leave. And we also added grandchildren and grandparents to eligible employees to take leave. And then there's also the, I think we spoke about before, House Bill 2744 requires employers of 25 or more persons in Oregon to provide leave for spouses of service members prior to deployment to, or leave during active duty. And then another significant piece of legislation from 2007 was Senate Bill 946, which required certain employers to allow eligible employees to take unpaid time to get treatment for domestic violence, sexual assault, or stalking. We've seen a lot in the press lately about what's been happening with victims of domestic abuse in the workplace. Okay, feel free to jump in. This is your chart if I'm going over.
Mr. Chair.
And before we go to Representative Holvey, we're talking about unpaid leave here, too.
That's true.
Right. Just so people listening don't. Representative Holvey.
I just got a really quick question that just kind of popped into my mind. On House Bill 2744, I was curious whether or not, the spouse was also employed by the military. Would this law apply to be able to require the military to give that spouse that 25 days off?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, I'll have to get back to you on that, to be honest. There's a parallel federal legislation, and I'd have to check to see if that may cover it as well, but I will definitely get back to you.
Representative Esquivel may be able to help us here.
We never thought of that. But an employer's an employer. I don't think it specifically says non-military or military, so one would assume, since I was the author of the bill, that my intent was it doesn't matter who you work for, period. That's what you deserve, that's what we deserve to give to the veteran, and that's what we deserve to give to the spouse.
And if it's not, then let's fix it.
Then we need to change it.
Right.
But please get back with me, because we need to change it if that isn't the case.
Chair Schaffler, Representative Esquivel, I will definitely get right back to you on that.
Okay, yeah, good idea.
And the next slide, and I'm not going to go through all of this, it's very dry but important stuff. It's called substantial equivalency, and some of you who have watched the Bureau over the last several years, we've been trying basically since 2003, and we finally have achieved substantial equivalency in our housing laws so that they're equivalent to the federal housing laws. The protections under federal law prior to the enactment of these series of bills was actually stronger than state law. When the Fair Housing Act was amended in 1991, Oregon law did not commensurately change. So Oregon was not allowed to investigate housing claims that were covered under both state and federal law. So with the passage of all these bills, the most significant were Senate Bill 725 in the 2007 session, which you can see amended several statutes to mirror federal law, and then House Bill 3639, through the special session in 2008, HUD granted us certification that we are now officially substantially equivalent. And since May of 2008, we've been assigned housing cases, and we've been taking in housing cases that are filed under both state and federal law. And we've taken in 162 cases just since May of 2008. So that's pretty significant. And we're glad to be able to do these investigations locally. Prior to this contract with HUD, when someone had a housing complaint that was being investigated out of Seattle, and sometimes it would take years to follow up on, they weren't able to do on-site investigations, so local investigations have benefited both the claimants and the respondents in these cases. The other bills below there were just some technical fixes that HUD asked us to get in 2009. And then just below that are miscellaneous bills, and I won't go through all of those, but one significant one is Senate Bill 874, which conformed Oregon's disability law with the federal ADA amendments bill that was passed in 2008 on the federal level. And you can see on the right we are in the middle of doing rule writing on several of these bills. And the part that I had a sheet that talked about the increased caseload. You've seen all these, and the chairman talked about that. We did not get any new specific staff for any of these bills. And I've been whining in Ways and Means Subcommittee and saying we're trying to do less with more. But I must say that the legislature at the end of session restored some of our positions that either we had to keep vacant for budget savings or we lost them. We had lost positions, and we're still not made whole. Where's my blue sheet? Here it is. But as you can see, this blue sheet, which I'm very proud of, the names in bold, Brandy Pirtle, Steph Plavonik, Moyad Proshna, Darcy Van Duzer, and soon Monica Mosley, these are all new staff people that will be taking on caseloads that were previously being absorbed by the existing staff. So, caseload of 55 to 65 cases that per investigator, this will really help ease the burden on the other employees. And I want to thank the legislature for allowing us to hire these folks. We just brought them on within the last 2 weeks, so we're in the process of training them. And hopefully that will provide for more efficient services to both respondents and complainants to get these cases closed in a more efficient manner. And I wasn't sure if you wanted me to go over my sheet with the state and federal. I just wanted to show that, state and private sector, that the number one type of claim we see on both the state and the federal level, the private sector, are retaliation claims. And you may hear about that. Someone can make a complaint in the workplace or file a complaint with us, and it may or may not have merit. But if they get treated differently by say, their supervisor or by shunned by coworkers, they can file another claim regardless of the merit of the first claim and get a retaliation claim. And those are easier to win in court. So we see a lot of people filing those. And we do a lot of trainings with management, the technical assistance for employers, to teach people to how not to be viewed as retaliating after a claim's been filed. And then you'll see that in the private sector, cases involving sex, and that could be sex maternity, different pay based on sex or sexual harassment is the number two form of claim, whereas in state agencies, disability is the number two form of claim. And then, again, disability is a high one in the private sector, but age is right up there in the front state agencies, and part of that is the aging workforce. In the private sector, injured worker claims are 21% of the cases, whereas for number four, it's sex in the first state agencies. And then race, color is pretty close. It's fifth for both the private sector and for the state government. And then family leave is about 15 to 16% for both the private sector and for state government. And then whistleblower claims are about 11% on the private sector, and state agencies about 15%. And this is just the types of filings. It's not about whether or not they're meritorious. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Yep. Thank you. Thanks for coming and giving us these. Do you have the numbers that go with these percentages?
Yeah.
I do.
That'd be good information if we could.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, Vice Chair Cameron, I can provide you with, this is a division monthly report, and it actually breaks them down by protected class. And I can make sure that this is available to the committee, and it has all the numbers, and it goes down to the months, every month, what type of case we get and what kind of inquiries we get. Would that be something you'd be interested in?
Yeah, just, well, the numbers that you came up with, I mean, the percentages are on this paper. Was it for what period and how many numbers of claims? And maybe if we know the amount of employees that are, you know, obviously when we're looking at state agencies, how many numbers of retaliation claims versus the total population of employees. Those types of numbers would be interesting. The other thing that I think would be interesting for me is just to, if there's any trends that are going on in the workforce, if you have these same numbers over the last, say, five-year period, to see what kinds of changes we've seen from complaints that are being filed with the agency would be interesting to have. And I know Representative Matthews had some questions.
Before we go to Representative Matthews, good thing retaliation and shunning doesn't apply to legislators, or I'd keep Representative Barton's entire firm busy. Seriously, though, Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm curious, when somebody, discrimination, I think.
When somebody files a claim and that's investigated by your agency, how is that case closed out? What's the status of it? Are they founded and unfounded, or how do you close those? So, as an example, I guess I'm really trying to get to the core. If somebody misrepresents the situation and that claim is therefore unfounded, let's say, or proven to be negligent, is there a consequence for that? Because it sounds like there's a consequence on the employer that could be viewed as retaliating. That's an easier case to claim. But if you have an employee that's fabricating stories just to get bully involved and it goes to investigation, well, is there a consequence at the end of this, or are they just simply founded unfounded?
Mr. Chair, Representative Matthews, I think it'd be helpful if I give you kind of the big picture, and then I'll hone down in this. Just so, the commissioner talked about the 32,000 inquiries that are fielded by three intake staff a year. That will translate, because a lot of it is something that we don't investigate, or it's not. It may be unfair, but not unlawful. We have a lot of that. Then that'll translate down to about 2,500 claims that are actually investigated by the agency, and about 10% or less of the claims do we find substantial evidence of unlawful discrimination. Because the way the law is written, people have the right to file whether or not the case has merit. However, we have a database system, so like we have people that we call frequent filers, and they file lots of claims, and once in a while they might have one that's meritorious, and then they think they're going to keep getting those. There is no consequence on our end. However, they will get a dismissal memorandum that will point out witness statements and the evidence provided by the respondent do not demonstrate that this person was unlawfully discriminated against based on whatever their protected class was. And those documents are all in the file, and it's subject to public records disclosure. If there's health information or other stuff we can't disclose, of course, that will be redacted, but any party and third parties can get copies of closed cases for their own usage. The media frequently actually gets copies of closed cases and how they were finally closed.
Thank you. It's a tough one, though. You don't want to discourage somebody from
Absolutely.
Coming forward saying I'm being mistreated. On the other hand, you know, anyone in this room could recognize someone who is frivolously abusing this system, but I don't. What do you do? So that's a tough call right there. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. How many of these are actually legitimate concerns? I mean, you have percentages here, so 1 out of 10, 1 out of 20. What is the actual ones that are upheld as being a problem?
Chairman Schaffer, Representative Esquivel, it's hard for me to say whether something's a concern or not, because a lot of people that file claims with us have legitimate employment, workplace concerns that involve protected classes or protected leave. If they're an injured worker, they've been harmed. They often can't make the connection between their harm, their protected class, and their harm. There has to be a link to it. It has to be because of their protected class. So you can identify as a racial minority and you got fired, but you have to prove the reason you got fired was that it was because of your race or your injured worker status. So the issues, the protected classes, I would say, are all real issues. Whether or not we were able to find evidence linking somebody's protected class or protected activity, such as whistleblowing, and the termination or different treatment they receive, that's what our responsibility is, to focus on that connection.
And that's a high bar.
It is a high
bar. To prove you've been fired because you're protected class or because you're injured or...
Well, the largest one was retaliation. So how do I say that Mike let me go because he didn't like me or something like that? Or he's retaliating against me for some reason. How do you prove that?
Chairman Schaffler, Representative Esquivel, if someone presented to me just how you spoke, we'd say that sounds like a sad story, but you're not identifying a protected class. You would have to have been retaliated for engaging in what was viewed as protected activity. So you filed a claim with BOLI, or you called OSHA to complain about a workplace safety issue, then you could say that you were retaliated against because you did that. And then our job would be to see if there is a connection between your termination and your protected activity. And if there wasn't, then we have to dismiss the claim.
And we have more things to do today, but I have one more question, unless others have questions. On the whistleblower, and there's something jumps out. It looks like people in state agencies are more inclined to report a potential problem than private. It's just something that looks like that, according to this data. On the whistleblower, we passed that law protecting whistleblowers. Do you see these numbers going down because of that, or not, or up?
Chairman Schaffler?
Obviously, we already had it in state, but on the private side.
Yeah, you know, these numbers are similar. I mean, we'd have to look at the aggregate numbers, and there were some good points made about that. But just as a trend, whistleblowing and retaliation claims seem to be increasing. A lot of that is because if a claim gets a lot of media attention, then others will file claims. And sometimes it can be based on a legitimate concern, and other times it's media attention, to be real honest.
The media is always helpful. Any further? Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Clare, thank you again for your work and for coming down. Just one last question on this piece of paper. Since, of course, the numbers add up to a number greater than 100%, mm-hmm. I assume that, obviously, one claim can trigger multiple categories. However, just for my own sake, wouldn't whistleblower also, or every whistleblower, because it is by nature a subset of retaliation, is all 11% that's reflected here in whistleblower also reflected in the 27% in retaliation? Did that make sense?
Chairman Schaffler, Representative Barton, first of all, I'll answer the question, and when we get you this report, you'll understand. Most people that file on multiple protected classes, so it doesn't add up to 100, and we can get you the one that adds up to 100, but I think it's more real. Most people like to throw a bunch of stuff at the wall and hope that something sticks, to be frank.
That's what we do in the legislature.
Yeah.
But, Mr. Chair, just follow up.
Yes.
So does that mean, is all whistleblowing also by definition retaliation?
Chairman Schaffler, Representative Barton, no. But it's complicated because there's different statutes that deal with whistleblowing, and this is an aggregate number. There's nurses that whistleblow under a different statute that work in a hospital setting. There's whistleblower protections for private and public employers, so they're going to cite different statutes. And then retaliation can be retaliation for something other than whistleblowing. It could be retaliation for filing a claim based on a race case, which would not be whistleblowing. Hope that's responsive.
And committee members, these folks aren't going anywhere, and I think I'm going to cut them loose unless there's something absolutely, you have to hear today. I do appreciate all the work you're doing. Kate, did you have something specific you were going to add today?
No.
Because we have some nice people patiently waiting on the agenda, and I want to get moving.
Yeah, no, I don't have anything to add except for to make myself available if folks have any questions kind of following up after the hearing on any of the pieces that we presented. I'm
great.
Available.
And thank you very much. Keep up the good work. All righty then. I'd like to call Tim Martinez. He's going to come up and introduce some nice people in the banking industry. And then after they're done, we'll be done for the day. That's state property.
I'll fix it.
We don't have any money.
As chairman, that's a prevailing wage.
That's right.
Even if he pays for it out of his own pocket.
I got that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. I want to thank you for giving us this opportunity to come back before you. We did so, I think, towards the end of session and kind of gave you a brief update at that point about what was going on in Oregon banking and lending in the state. I would be remiss if I don't send Linda Navarro's apologies. In June, you had her introduce the panel. I apologize for having been stuck with me this time, but she is out of state on business travel. I'm joined by three very distinguished and involved members of the Oregon Bankers Association, as well as senior members of their own banks. To my far right is Bob Snavice. I apologize to your administrator for getting her the wrong title. It's President and Chief Executive Officer of West Coast Bank. And he's also chairman of the board this year of the Oregon Bankers Association. West Coast Bank is pretty much up and down the Willamette Valley, and he'll talk more about his institution. Next to him is Anne-Marie Malam, who's the President and Chief Executive Officer of Summit Bank, which is located in Representative Holby's hometown of Eugene, and we're glad she could join us as well. And then sitting to my immediate right is Steve Philpott, Executive Vice President and General Counsel from Umpqua Bank. And I think of the three, Steve was here in June and addressed the committee. So what we thought we would do, with your permission, Mr. Chair, is lead off with Bob. Let him make some introductory remarks. They're all prepared, I think, to go between 5 and 7 minutes each. And then whatever your pleasure is, whether you want to ask them questions after they finish or when the panel's done, we're prepared to go either way.
Great. Go ahead, sir.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Representative Schaffler and the committee, for giving us an opportunity to talk today. I'm Bob Snavice. I'm the President and Chief Executive Officer of West Coast Bank, and also, as was stated, Chairman of the Oregon Bankers Association this year.
For those of you who don't know, the Oregon Bankers Association has been the voice of the banking industry for over 100 years. We represent the state and national commercial and savings banks of all sizes within the state of Oregon. As you know, the Oregon FDIC insurance depository institutions are highly regulated at both the state and the national level. Today we have 36 banks headquartered in the state of Oregon, of which 32 are chartered at the state level. In addition, we represent 18 state and national banks that have branches in Oregon that are headquartered outside of the state of Oregon. And 9 of these 18 out-of-state banks are actually headquartered in the state of Washington. Our association members, we strive to be good corporate citizens. We think Oregon is a great place to do business. The success of our business is clearly linked to the economy, both on a national and a local basis. And I would like to take a few minutes to talk a little bit about the national economy because, as you all know, we are deeply impacted by that. And I also think it gives you a perspective in terms of the question of, you know, lending. The state of Oregon is also heavily influenced by what's going on a national basis. As you know, some people have declared the recession over from a technical standpoint, but for many of our citizens and companies in the state of Oregon, we know that's not to be true because unemployment still remains high. And there are still many people looking for work, and I think most people have acknowledged that this generally will be a jobless recovery over the next several years because the pace of unemployment has slowed, but still the absolute low of unemployment is rising. Unemployment is a big factor in our economy from a lending standpoint is because jobs are a critical source of income for people, which then gives them the ability or the lack of ability to borrow money and or to repay money that's been borrowed. It also has a huge impact on businesses, especially if you are an owner of a commercial building, because if you have fewer jobs, you're taking less space in that building, and there's more unoccupied space in the building, and since if there's more unoccupied space, that means the rent, that it's more difficult for the owner of the building to pay rent because their revenues are down and there's more space, and the laws of supply and demand take place. If there's less jobs, there's less space utilized, less utilization of the buildings, there's a lower valuation of the buildings, and so it's more difficult to borrow against that building. So it's just a small example of how it really jobs are a critical thing that affect many and all aspects of the economy. The unemployment is also a big factor. For years it's been talked about how the consumer has overextended themselves. Well, now the consumer is at what we call repairing their balance sheets. They're spending less money than they have in the past, and savings it is an all-time high. The implications of that is that people are spending less, and with the economy being two-thirds driven by the consumer, their individual balance sheets are getting better. But on the other hand, by buying purchases of goods and services, less demand, it's not as good for all the businesses in which they buy from. So you can see the importance of jobs in the national economy. Also, if you look at some of the Federal Reserve data on households in December of 2007, the net worth of households by the Federal Reserve was valued to be $64 billion. And if you go to June of 2009, the net worth of those households had declined by $11 billion, or almost 20%. Now, the value for most individuals on a household basis lies with the value of their home or their real estate or the amount of debt. So you can see in less than 2 years how household balance sheets and their net worth collectively in this country has declined dramatically. And that gets to the part of thinking about lending. Bankers look to lend with a source of repayment. Generally, the source of repayment is either their job or their salary, or the value of the security they have in their home, with homes being worth less between 15% and 30% from a year ago, you can clearly see that homeowners have less equity and less assets to borrow against. And with fewer jobs, they have less income to apply for new loans for source of repayment. Mortgages have also become more difficult in this environment because of the challenges that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have had. And most of the new mortgages are being done by the Federal Home Loan, the FHA. And that agency also is suffering because their now equity ratio is, their leverage ratio is now in excess of 50-1. And they have created another form of lending in this country, which is could be the next subprime crisis that our national government is going to have to deal with. So there's a lot of things going on at the moment, both from a monetary policy and a fiscal policy, that makes this environment very challenging. And technically, the last recession that just ended, as I talked about earlier, has been the longest recession since the Great Depression back in the 1930s. So clearly, we're all in very challenging times, and that challenging times also applies to the Oregon banking industry, because being part of this communities where we live, where we work, where we employ people, where we support the organization that goes on, everyone's been impacted to a certain degree by that. The banks are still active in their communities. They're still providing jobs. They're still promoting economic development. They're making new loans. But if you go to the survey that's done by the Federal Reserve of commercial bank lenders, the credit standards have changed dramatically, and credit standards have increased by 25% to 30% in the most recent survey. The good news is that's down from a year ago, when 80% to 90% of the credit officers in the country were saying that their credit standards had tightened even more. So we have seen a decline, or I should say an improvement in credit standards, but given the economic environment, there's clearly less qualified buyers than there has been at any given point in time in a long time. So we're all very cognizant of that. We all understand the situation, and we're working real hard to do the best we can in this environment. On the regulatory front, the industry, as always, has been highly regulated. That's a good thing. It also provides a lot of structure. We have over 6,000 pages of federal regulation plus state regulations that are in place to protect depositors. We are now seeing an increase in that. The pace of regulatory change has increased dramatically. There's been, over the last year and a half, over 100 new bills that have been proposed or implemented relative to regulating banking. Unfortunately, the term bank has been used to describe a lot of kinds of institutions, from the investment banks that are based in New York to the community banks that are in the cities across the state of Oregon, and I can assure you they're all not the same. They're very different business models. They're very different rules that they're subjected to, and very different sense of regulatory oversight. However, sometimes the word bank is used interchangeably and describes a lot of types of institutions, and I think it needs to be important to understand the context in which the word bank is being used and banker is being used. So, needless to say, we are in a very interesting time and challenging time, and thank you very much for your time and attention.
Thanks, Bob. And I am Anne Marie Malam with Summit Bank in Eugene, Oregon. And I want to thank Representative Schaffler and the committee for inviting us here. I don't really have prepared comments, and we didn't really have time. We're all working very hard right now to compare notes. But Bob, I think, did a very good job of sort of summarizing some of the challenges that we're facing. Summit Bank in Eugene is mostly focused on businesses and professionals, so we're a business bank, and Bob gave you an example of what's happening with sort of households and their challenges with credit, and I'll share an example with you of what's happening with commercial credit as asset values are falling. We have a client that's a strong company in Eugene that invests in real estate and in various forms, earning assets and bare land and development, and other side businesses. We made them a loan 3 years ago to start a business. We wouldn't usually make a startup loan to a company, but they had lots of collateral, and so instead of them going and selling their collateral and using that money to start this business, we made them a loan to start a business, secured with collateral that was at the time put us at a loan-to-value of about 60%, which was well within sound safety and soundness and well within guidelines. And they're paying as agreed, and they've always paid as agreed, and they're still, they've never been late. And but one of the things that we're having to do now, and I'm going to get to a little conversation a bit more about the regulatory environment, is we're having to sort of reappraise collateral, even on performing loans. So we reappraised the value of this collateral, and last week on Friday we got the appraisal, and it's now worth 50% what it was worth then, which to me is a pretty bogus number to begin with, because there is no buying and selling of properties like this going on at all. I mean, so you could argue that it's worth nothing, or you could argue that it's worth what it might be worth in 2 years or what it was worth 2 years ago. But what that what we're required to do is we're required to go to the borrower then and ask them to pay that loan down so that we're back into a safe margin, or we have to write off the difference. And even though they continue to pay the payments, and their intention is to hold that property and to get through this and at some time in the future develop this property. So it's an extreme pressure on bank earnings. It's also an extreme pressure that requires us to pressure our clients. And it's kind of exacerbating the situation. We have, you know, assets values falling. I mean, we've seen it in our 401k accounts with equities, and commercial real estate is kind of the next big one that I think is still happening in Oregon. I think it's going to continue to happen, but it's happening even more because we're kind of required to get more appraisals and exacerbate that problem, which I think pushes it down even further. So that's a frustration that we have. One of the things that's happening, I think, what's happening with the regulatory agencies is because we do need some financial reform, and we're finally, I think, getting some attention to that, the environment is that the regulatory agencies are all kind of fighting for their lives right now. I mean, it's the OCC and the FDIC and everybody sort of wanting to make sure that they survive this game and become a player. And they're also, I think, trying to prove that they've been criticized because they have banks that maybe 2 years ago were rated pretty strong, and now they're on the failed list. And so the Office of the Inspector General and various, you know, entities have been criticizing the regulatory agencies for maybe not doing a good job, when in fact I think a big portion of this problem has to do with this downward cycle of asset values. So I think there's an overcompensation right now with the regulatory agencies to make darn sure that they don't overrate the safety and soundness of a bank, which causes additional pressures, which makes it really difficult to continue to lend money, which is what we all are here to do. We're a traditional bank. A traditional bank basically takes deposits from people in our community and businesses and tries to take very good care of them and makes them available to them and lend them over here to prudent, good business endeavors that are going to create jobs and, you know, keep the economy moving. Most of the banks in Oregon, that's what we do, and those activities are being hampered right now. And you know, the administration wants us to lend money, and we're trying. And I think most banks. I did see a chart that was pretty interesting, which was the last 5 quarters of total lending. It showed, and I didn't bring it, but I could get it to anybody that wants to see it. I think it was the 22 largest banks in the country that have a huge amount of assets. It showed quarter by quarter their total loan volumes going down. And then it showed all the banks under $5 billion in total assets. And we're all still going up, creeping up, trying to continue to lend money. And I thought that was kind of interesting. But it's difficult. It's a difficult environment. We're spending a lot of time with customers, trying to help them work through these issues, trying to get them to survive, because, of course, we need our companies to survive. And I don't want to whine because I'm not whining about it. I think it's important that everybody kind of knows what all the pressures are that we're all facing in whatever we're doing. So
if you're not whining, you're the only one in the building today.
Trying not to.
Please forgive me for that.
Yeah.
Go ahead, sir.
Funny because it's true.
So I'll just pass on to you.
Thank you, Anne-Marie. Chairman Schaffler, members of the committee, thank you for inviting Umpqua Bank back to
testify before the committee. My colleagues have very adequately addressed the banking environment that we are in.
Oh, excuse me, sir. Did you identify yourself?
Oh, yes. I'm Steve Philpott, Executive Vice President and General Counsel of Umpqua Bank. And they've done a very good job of identifying the and describing the environment we are in. I just thought I'd take a minute and remind the committee about Umpqua Bank and our footprint and what we do, and then give you some specifics about what's been happening at Umpqua Bank as far as lending and so forth to kind of illustrate that environment. Umpqua Bank is the largest state-chartered bank in Oregon. So you've got represented here Ann Marie's bank, which I think is a one-branch bank. In Eugene, we've got 154 branches in three states, including Oregon, Northern California, and Southwestern Washington. I would tell you that although 55% of our assets are located in Oregon and Southwestern Washington, 45% in California, there's really not a lot of difference as far as the economic environment in our footprint. The numbers I'll give you are our bank-wide numbers. They're not specific to Oregon. Throughout our footprint, you'll find areas that are doing better than others. In Oregon, certainly, our Bend market is extremely distressed, being as dependent as it is on real estate and construction activity. Portland market is certainly less so than Bend. Sacramento was 2 years ago extremely distressed and is seems to be bouncing back a little bit. But anyway, it's a rough go wherever you look in the Northwest, frankly. Our commercial loan demand is down this year versus last year. New originations are roughly equal to our loan paydowns, payoffs, and charge-offs. And so our loan growth has been really quite flat and on the commercial side. Our commercial borrowers with lines of credit continue to be very cautious. And so these commercial lines of credit are made available to businesses for the purpose of financing new inventory that they might want to buy in order to fill new orders or something like that, or to purchase new equipment to expand their operation. That's what those lines of credit are typically used for. Average utilization of those lines of credit now is about 35%, and in good times it runs between 50 and 60%. So that tells us that businesses have credit available to them, but because of the economic climate, they're choosing not to take advances on those lines and use them. They're pulling in their horns still. Our mortgage loan activity, on the other hand, has been very strong in 2009. 30-year fixed rates range from about 4.8% to 5.4% over most of this year. Through the first 9 months of 2009, our overall closed loan mortgage volume was up 126% over the comparable period in 2008. Early in the year, in Q1, the mix was roughly 20% purchases and 80% refinances. And over the course of the year, that has changed quite a bit. In Q3, it was 43% purchases and 57% refinances. We have a serviced mortgage loan portfolio consisting of about 9,500 loans with $1.4 billion outstanding. I'm very pleased to say that our portfolio has been performing very well, though. And even though any foreclosure is unfortunate, so far this year to date, we've only completed six mortgage foreclosures in that portfolio. Last year, all of last year, it was five, and we've done 36 mortgage modifications this year under the federal programs and through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Deposits have been another bright spot for us. Total deposits increased $401 million, or 6% on a sequential quarter basis in the third quarter. So we've seen good, strong deposit growth. And certainly our challenge, along with the challenge of most of the banks in our area, is credit cost. We added $52 million to our loan loss provision in the third quarter, charged off $47 million in that same quarter. We've been able to keep our non-performing assets down to 1.7% at the end of the third quarter, but that's certainly still for us a very elevated number. We'd like to see that below 1%, but it hasn't been below 1% for about 2.5 years now. So anyway, it's an extremely tough environment. There are some bright spots, but it's difficult to see it turning around in the near term, frankly. I think most of us at Umpqua believe that 2010 is going to continue to be a very difficult year.
Well, I appreciate it. Are you finished
yet? I am. I
okay,
just
good. Thank you. I was on the and participated in the governor's task force on mortgage lending, which started in 2006, and learned more about this than I ever wanted to know. There's one thing I know about the economy: nobody has any answers, let alone all of them. And you need a crystal ball and know how to read it to find out what's going to happen. I don't think a jobless recovery is a recovery, especially if you ain't got a job. I mean, I'm not blaming you guys for that. I'm just saying that as a work advocate for workers. But I do want to say this. I agree with you that we do not need to make a quilt work of regulation in this country. I certainly do not want to have more regulation in this state that makes it more difficult for our state-regulated banks to do business, because we don't regulate a lot of several larger federal regulated banks. So I don't see how it helps my local economy to make it harder for locally state regulated banks to do business. For the life of me, you have to have cash flowing to have a strong economy. That being said, I urge you to be in close contact with our federal delegation, and something's going to happen, and it's either going to happen there or it's going to happen here. If it happens there, it's a lot easier for me as a policymaker to say, hey, Noel, look at these new regulations. Whatever it is, to be honest with you, I don't even care what it is, because I don't know enough to speak intelligently about it. But if there isn't anything happens there, your task in this building will be more difficult, with me or without me. I just wanted to share that with you. That comes as no surprise. I've shared it with the people that represent
you. There's no doubt it's an avalanche of new regulation on the federal level, and it hasn't stopped, and it's not going to stop anytime soon.
And I hope it isn't an avalanche. I hope it's an avalanche that makes things better, clearer, fairer, more helpful. And if not, then I'm concerned about that as a citizen too. But I'd rather have the avalanche stop there than come pouring into here. You see where I'm going with all this? Mm-hmm. Okay, good. I hope I make myself clear. Representative Barton, then Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question, I suppose, for any of you. It's follow-up to that. I think that at the federal level, in addition to this additional regulation, I suspect that this falling away, if you're familiar with the United States Senator Dodd's proposals, I think we're going to see, probably for the first time in the post-war era, significant institutional reform of the very institutions that regulate the financial sector in this country. What that will ultimately look like, I don't think any of us can really predict, but I think we can predict some kind of institutional reform. Do you anticipate or at least foresee that this body might have to act and adjust the institutions we have in the state to somehow either in response to that federal action or, for example, to better cooperate with them or to reflect the new federal regime better?
You guys want to take that, or
go ahead,
Senator Dodd's proposal for a single federal regulator is extremely problematic for the banking industry, and particularly we have a two charter system. We have state chartered banks and we have federally chartered banks. The state chartered banks are regulated by their own state banking authorities and the FDIC, and the federally chartered banks are regulated by the OCC. And that system has worked relatively well. Typically, you'll find your multi-state larger banks chartered as national banks and your smaller local community banks as state chartered banks. Umpqua Bank is a state chartered bank, as I mentioned earlier, and we are in three states. I would tell you that it's extremely difficult to be a state chartered bank in three states because we don't get the full benefit of federal preemption that the federally chartered banks get. And so one thing that I always ask my state legislators to think about when they're considering passing legislation that would affect banks is to realize that for the most part, what you do on the state level is only going to affect your state chartered banks. And the national banks, the B of A's, the Wells, the U.S. banks of the world are in large part going to be exempt from your any legislation that you might pass because of federal preemption. So, and it's always been, I think, pretty much a well-received argument by those of us that are state-chartered banks, you know, to keep the playing field level. Don't place burdens on us that are not going to be felt by the national banks. So I think, and until recently, preemption has been pretty strong on the federal level. Some of the new legislation that's been proposed would allow a baseline. For example, the Consumer Financial Protection Agency at the federal level would regulate consumer disclosures and activities by all banks and set a baseline performance level or baseline requirements, but allow states to enact more stringent requirements. That's also extremely problematic for those of us that operate across state lines. You'd like to think that, for the most part, there's going to be a standard regulation, whether we're doing business in California or Oregon or Idaho or Washington, wherever. It's extremely difficult to predict. My sense of it now is that, given the politics and the political clout of some of the agencies that would be affected by a single federal regulator proposal, that's unlikely to be enacted as is. But that's just my guess. Yeah, I'm done.
Can I add something to
Please.
That? I would just say that, to me personally, the biggest issue that this bill and other people that are trying to solve the financial reform issues has to do with the too big to fail issue. And I think that until we figure out a way to, whether it's banking or auto industry or insurance companies or whatever it is, but until we figure out a way to let capitalism work, and this is a personal opinion, this is probably not a opinion of the OBA, it might be, but until we figure out a way to let capitalism work, we're going to be at risk with giant companies that have systematic risk that our government won't allow to fail. We're going to be at risk for them coming up, and it's not a negative thing. They're in business to grow, coming up with ways to make more money, and coming up with ways to, well, just make more money. And we have to, if they're irresponsible ways, they have to be allowed to take their lumps and fail. And we have to figure out a way to dismantle or figure out a way to take them through bankruptcy or something. And I think, to me, though, that's the most important part of what they're dealing with back there, and I haven't heard a good solution yet. And that will have some effect if they grapple with that, you know, with that issue. But I do think it's really too soon to really try and measure the impacts of, you know, what we're going to be dealing with here, because there's still so much back there.
Okay, Representative Esquivel, then Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been a realtor since about 1990, I think, or 92. and I remember I used to sell $60,000 homes. And then 5 years ago, you couldn't buy a lean-to in the middle of a field for less than $250,000. But today, we are currently selling $60,000 homes. We've done a complete circle. Why? In my particular area, for a five-year stint, we accelerated in value 17.43 at a minimum, to almost 22% per year. Well, anyone can figure you can't sustain that. It had to come to a stop. And when it came to a stop this time, which is different than we've had in the past, because I've been in ups and downs, this time it came to a stop like a ball rolling off a table. Like you'd flip the switch. It just stopped, period. Which was the first time in my career that that has ever happened. The value, or the loss of value, is we can all point to each other. We can point to state government. We can point to federal government. We can point to Freddie, Fannie, banks, anyone, realtors, speculators. But the truth of the matter is, the problem with a lot of this is your foreclosures. Because when you go out to do an assessment and you get an appraisal, they have to take the low ball, which is the REOs, which is your foreclosure properties, and put that in, even though the people that have done nothing wrong have a, in my opinion, there's a two different sets here. You have someone that has done fine, and their values drop 30% or 40%, and it's because of the people that couldn't pay for their houses. So, consequently, we're caught up in that. And, example, we own a house that 5 years ago, 4 years ago, appraised out at $420-some thousand. Today, we did a CMA on it, and I think it's worth about $310,000. Okay, a house hasn't changed, nothing's changed, but the values have changed. So consequently, what you just stated about your individual that you'd lent money to on an asset basis, unfortunately, I'm reading like you changed the rules on them. You all of a sudden said, okay, you know, you were worth $1 million. Today, you're only worth $500,000, so I want you to make up for it. Well, you know, that's pretty hard for me to choke down. I don't think that's quite right, because if we made an agreement, we made an agreement. Although I understand it. I understand it completely. I think the worst thing that we can do is regulate, because it seems like it's always a knee-jerk reaction. The one thing that we do is pass laws, and when we pass laws, it seems like we pass laws just to be passing laws to make it look like we're doing something instead of thinking of what now? What if? What's the consequences? We've done that with the mortgage brokers. We've done that with several entities in this building. And I think we have to be very careful, because looking at government track record, I'm not real sure what we do well. We do military very well, and I'm speaking of federal government now. But regulation, I'm not sure we do that real well. I'm not sure that it isn't time that we let the capitalistic economy come forward and be just what it's supposed to be, a free economy.
There's some work that needs to be done on the land use, water use, and taking advantage of our natural resources in the state. And how
natural resources, especially.
Representative Shoffer, can I respond to that?
Yeah, because please. I don't know. There's a lot there to respond to.
Yeah, well, the part about us, you know, going back and changing the rules, that's exactly what I don't want to do. What I want to do as a banker is I want to go to that borrower and say, hey, you know, we're in this pickle, and I don't want to change the rules on you. I'd like us to just take a breath. I don't want to even get another appraisal and have someone tell me that it's worth 50%, because it doesn't matter. We've made the loan. They're paying as it agreed. I don't want to do anything. And what's happening is that I'm telling you that our regulators are saying this is what you have to do because they're trying to make up for supposedly you're missing something over the last few years. And I think that's happening. Hopefully that's going to start swinging back the other direction. But it would be like if, you know, if your car lender came back to you and said, okay, hey, your car's just worth $1,000 now, so you got to pay me down $4,000 of that loan, which that's not happening on the consumer side. It is happening from the regulators on the commercial side, and I don't like it. That's why I was telling you the story, and we're trying not to do that. And if we don't do it, though, in some cases, they're saying, okay, you have to write that off as a loss. Well, is it really a loss? We don't know if it's ever going to be a loss. We're hoping it's never going to be a loss, but I don't like it either. So, thank you.
Before I go to Representative Witt and Representative Hovia, what about it separating, going back to when investment bankers and lending bankers were never to meet? Are they going to do that at the federal level?
Probably have differing opinions on that.
Well, Chairman, Mr. Chairman, I think that's a very good question. And there's a lot of things that were done with credit default swaps, derivatives, those kinds of instruments, which, you know, not to find fault, but contributed to the situation. And in my view, there should be regulation, knowing what is the credit default swap book, what is the derivative book, who's on the other side of those. And if that information had been done and followed through and regulated, I think that's an excellent example where we do need regulation and thoughtful regulation about how to control that stuff. Unfortunately, the markets that were in place, which were taking the mortgages that were being originated and then securitized and then sold, flowed very freely. And when you have credit flowing very freely, then what you create is an unnatural supply and demand. And I think that's, as a country, what we kind of experienced. And along the way, those checks and balances were missing, and that supply and demand. And, you know, as lenders, during those time periods, if we had made no loans the last 2 years, we'd be far better off today. However, if we had made no loans the last 2 years, I can imagine the criticism that we would have received from our customers and our constituencies about why aren't you making loans? And that would have been an unanswerable question. So we, unfortunately, are where we are, and I think we need some thoughtful people to think about some of what were the aspects that contributed to it and focus on the institutions and the organizations that really control the flow of money. And I think confidently say it's not your community banks who are controlling the flow of money and who are controlling the flow of the mortgage-backed security market, who are controlling the flow of securitized loans and the things that you know were a part of. We were a part of it, and there's no denying that. But like I said, if we had made no loans the last 2 years, my guess is some of us would have been would have had questions asked, why weren't you making loans?
If I owned stock in your bank, I'd be asking you why you're out there making me money.
Yeah.
So I can.
So it's a dilemma that we all face, and I think collectively, hopefully, we'll solve for it with some thoughtful regulation.
Go ahead.
I think, Chairman Schaffer, from my perspective, the answer to your question is: are the policymakers distinguishing between the money center and investment banks and local community banks? The answer is really not really. Mm-hmm. Not enough. And I would offer as an example the too big to fail legislation that's now being considered. The guts of the proposal is that an assessment would be levied upon certain banks to fund, to create a fund, much like the FDIC's resolution fund, but a separate fund for those institutions that are deemed to be systemically significant and too big to fail, so that we would be able to have a mechanism to, in essence, fund depository losses and so forth, not depository losses, but other losses, if they were shut down, if they had to be shut down. Right now, the exemption in that legislation is for banks of $10 billion in assets or less. Well, I'm here to tell you that we're a plain vanilla community bank, and we're at $9.2 billion in assets. So very shortly, if our plans go according to Hoyle, you know, we will be paying into a special assessment that, in essence, benefits the too big to fail systemically important institutions, and we're not part of the club. There's nobody's going to say Umpqua Bank's too big to fail, but we're going to be paying for it.
That is interesting. All right, Representative Witt, then Representative Hovey, then Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With your indulgence and the indulgence of the good bankers before us, I'd like to have them perhaps comment on something that I found incredulous yesterday in another committee. Several members sitting here today heard it also. Representative Gilliam, who was just here a moment ago, also heard it. It came from a banker who on the basis of his statement, couldn't possibly have been a member of the OBA, and I'm sure probably was not a graduate of any accredited school in financing, economics, or banking. But he told us that the very best thing that... let me back up for a minute here. Started off his testimony by saying that as a commercial banker, he was finding it exceedingly difficult to write commercial loans. No surprise there. And then proceeded to tell us that the very best thing that we could do for state policy in terms of energy was to increase the price of gasoline to $4 a gallon. And I was shocked. I was shocked in the face of, Mr. Chairman, a report yesterday that finds Oregon and Mississippi, the two states with the worst hunger rate in the nation. I've got people in my district over 20% out of a job. They can't put food on their table. They're finding it increasingly difficult to have shelter. And we had a member of the banking community, not represented here, come and tell us the very best thing that we could do was raise energy prices by 50%. That was an insult to me, Mr. Chairman, and I would just, with the indulgence here, ask these good bankers if they would be in agreement that the way to write banking loans or the way to stimulate or recover our state's economy is by raising energy prices by 50%. And Mr. Chairman, I'm asking this question because I know as well as my own last name that the reason they used this person yesterday was to drive home a point. All right, that the path to green renewable energy in this state is to jack prices up so high on energy prices that all of a sudden green energy becomes competitive. So with that, Mr. Chairman, if you would excuse my emotionalism here, I'd like these bankers' commentary.
Before the answer, I'm not a mind reader, but I'll bet this person doesn't want to build any LNG terminals or any pipelines in this state either. Go ahead, which I do. Go ahead, please.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, I'll go ahead and take that one for the team, if it's okay. I don't know who that was, Representative Witt. I would certainly like to find out. That clearly is not the position of the Oregon Bankers Association. I'm pretty confident in saying it's not the position of anybody here at this table. I would be certainly interested in meeting with you afterwards and finding out who they were and which bank they were from.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Anything else, Representative?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that.
Representative Holby, then Cameron, then Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just not sure where I was equally appalled at that comment, but I just racked it up to some of you who didn't know what they were talking about. But trying to remember what the hell I wanted to ask now. Excuse the language. I was going to respond to something Representative Esquivel had to say about regulation, but actually, Bob, I'm going to attempt your last name, addressed that issue just about that there is a need for regulation at some level to keep us, in an economic situation that we can continue to thrive in. So having said that, and I also, you know, wanted to mention that we in this building did do some regulation around loan originators and such. That is true, but it was also working with the bankers on that. It was something that the federal government was basically instructing us that we better do, and I believe it's a good step and a good piece of regulation, actually. One thing that Representative Escobar also said that I actually agree, I have some concern about the values of property as such, and I'm certain that the financial industry and the banking industry also have those same concerns about the value of our property, especially as foreclosures are increasing. And there's been a number of people that have asked me some questions about foreclosure, and also about what is the responsibility of the people that hold those foreclosed properties to their neighborhoods, because there are some neighborhoods that are starting to even accelerate further in a devaluation of their property because the foreclosed properties are becoming blighted. And not real fair to the neighbors that are actually making their mortgage payments and watching that acceleration, because whoever owns the foreclosed property turns all the power off throughout the winter, and the house starts growing mold, and becomes a nuisance as such. And I don't know if our laws really prevent that from happening so much. Maybe some city ordinances here and there can address weeds and things like that, perhaps. But I'm kind of curious what your take on that issue is, and whether or not something should be done about it, because I know some states have stepped in to try to do something about allowing foreclosed properties to continue to deteriorate and blight a neighborhood.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holvey, I would respond to that, at least from our perspective. We have had a number of properties like that, and in our view, it's in our best interest to maintain those properties, to secure them with fencing or whatever the appropriate thing is, to make sure that they cannot be vandalized, to be sure that they are kept in good repair. For a lot of reasons, but the primary reason, and you could say it's self-serving, but it enhances the value of the property and maintains the value of the property so that when it does come time to dispose of it, we can get the maximum price. And I think that's what most bankers will do. Now, there are lots of mortgage companies that are going through this, and I don't know if their philosophy is the same, but speaking for ourselves, that's clearly our philosophy. And because these are communities where we live, where we work, where our people live and work, where we sponsor events. And so our reputation is very important to us in these communities. So, for us, it's not even a question of what our strategy is and what our values dictate that we do.
Can I add something to that one, too?
Please, go ahead.
Chairman Shoffler and Representative Holvey. To me, this is another one of those issues that there are abusers, and then there are, people that, banks that are here. I mean, there is no reason, there's no incentive for a local banker to have a property that gets run down or devalued. And the closer you are to your customers, the less likely you are to have that kind of thing happen. And it's like overdraft fee abuse or any of these other things that are in the press. When you have a company that is 10 million miles from their clients and 15,000 layers from their clients and 15 million, whatever, from a piece of property, the chances are it may not be handled responsibly. That's, again, my personal view. And I would bet that if you go and you look up who owns that property, and it's not going to be an Oregon bank.
Representative Cameron, then Representative Thatcher, then Representative Escobar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to thank the panel for giving us a real broad view and even narrowing down some of the details of what's happening even in our neighborhoods. And it really was great for me. A question from some of the comments we talked about loans and what businesses, you know, who's borrowing, who's not borrowing, or what you have available. And I have a question. What type of businesses today are trying to borrow money that would, if they could borrow money, would promote job growth? Do you have any businesses that are coming to your door saying, if I could only get this loan, I could expand my business and grow jobs?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cameron, I would respond to it in this way. Our loan-to-deposit ratio is probably less than 80%. Like was mentioned for Umpqua Bank, you know, we are in the business of taking deposits in the communities and lending money. So we are very much supportive of doing that because that is our business. I would also have to say, consistent with what was talked about, the consumer is tentative, businesses are tentative. There's such uncertainty about so many topics on a national level, and I don't want to dramatize it, but with all the uncertainty of all the conversations that are going on a national level, and the, whether the perceptions are accurate or not in terms of the impact on small business, people are just waiting and watching. In most cases. Now, clearly, there are people who have contracts with public projects for building thing that has come through stimulus money, either locally or nationally, that are doing many things. But those are rare at this point in time. And people, I think, are just they're worried. I haven't seen a time period in my banking career, which 30-plus years, where they view so much uncertainty both on the local and the national level, and especially on the national level.
And it isn't just economic uncertainty. If I'm a business person and I don't know what the rules are going to be, why would I want to dive into something? Because you know what? If the rules are going to change, my investment could be wiped away. Go ahead.
And Mr. Chair, if anybody else wanted to comment on that, and what I'm hearing you say, that basically there is no business out there that has a model for growth right now that's coming to a bank and saying, I'd like to get money but can't get money.
We have some little bright spots in some areas, and I think it has to do with not like a whole industry. For example, in the restaurant business, the expensive restaurants are hurting. You know, the Subways are doing okay. So there's some demand there. Same thing, it's like resorts and golf clubs. The country clubs are hurting. The open community golf courses are doing a little better. You know, so we do see some bright spots, and I do think there are some companies that are focusing more on new sustainable things. And I don't say raise the gas price, but I think there are some opportunities, you know, in that area. So there are some bright spots, but not whole industries.
There's a huge potential in making this transition from fossil fuel to renewable. We're going to need more natural gas in this state, and I know a lot of nice people that would be more than happy to come to your bank and help get some financing to fund their projects. And, you know, it's those kinds of things that get in the way in this state that are keeping us down, to say nothing of taking for greater advantage of what do we do better in this state than anything else? Grow trees, develop more water, more flexible land use for industrial use in this state. I mean, we are our own worst enemy. And then what's that generate? That generates revenue to hire teachers, healthcare providers, firefighters, and cops, and then to make our community even better, more inviting to investment. And it's a vicious cycle to the bottom when we don't do that, and it's a wonderful, lofty flight up to the top when we do. All right, I'm going to shut up.
Amen, Mr. Chairman.
I want to throw one other question out, or maybe even get another response to that previous question, but we've talked about mortgage loans being up 120% over the previous year, I believe, and you talked about the differences and where those were, you know, refi versus new sales. 120% up
or is it 120% of?
Yes.
I mean, that sounds like a huge number.
It's a huge number. Yeah. I mean,
where is that based on the where? You know, in the generic big market, where is that coming from, and why are you being so successful with that, or is that a trend in all the banking industry?
I can only speak for Umpqua Bank, but I think we're seeing it in a couple of areas. Number one, we have really focused on that with long-term rates being as low as they are. We thought that was perhaps one bright spot and one opportunity that we could really pursue. I think you see a lot of the what I'll call the unregulated mortgage market has gone out of business, so I think we've taken some market share back into the banks that was spread among mortgage brokers and so forth in the past. And I'd say those are the two things for us. And I don't know how
I would just, excuse me, add to that, Mr. Chairman and Representative, the first buyer home buyer's credit, first time home buyer's credit, has been a very has contributed to that. Now, from a public policy standpoint, I'm not commenting on that, but that has driven volume, which we think is good. And you also, I think, need to keep in mind, with home prices down 15% to 30%, the affordability for those people that have jobs has increased dramatically. So it is attractive for the people who do have jobs. So it is a bright spot in what's going on. And the other thing, too, is there has been, you know, virtually no new residential development over the last 2 years because there hasn't been financing for residential developers to buy land, to develop land, and then ultimately build a home. So what's happening with our land use laws the way they are, and the lead time that it takes to take something from an idea to a development, the inventory of lots that are available to developing homes is shrinking because we still are a net in-migration state, and we still are a great place to live and work. So there's a level of activity, but it's just at a much lower level. And we're actually seeing buyers coming into the market buying site-ready land because they know it'll be 2 years before they can buy the land and get the approvals and then actually construct. So that is a bright spot, if you will, but it's as a result of what we've had to go through that it is on a relative basis a bright spot.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, if I could, Representative Cameron, I think what you're hearing as well is that, you know, up until maybe the last quarter, most of that growth, I think, was in more of the, you know, the first-time home buyer, the lower end of the market. But what I'm hearing from some of other bankers is that that's now starting to spread a little bit, and you're not at the top end of the market yet with a huge number of sales, but it is moving up ever so slightly as time passes.
Representative Thatcher, then Representative Esquivel, then Representative Holvey.
Okay, just shortly commenting, following up on what Representative Witt was saying earlier. I was also in that committee, along with Representative Holvey. I don't think anybody else here was. Anyway, us three were there. And his name was David Williams with the Shore Bank Pacific, which I believe is headquartered in Washington. That was my impression after looking at their website and also listening to testimony yesterday. But they're solely to their business model is to provide loans for environmentally sound, whatever, you know, green type of project. So that, of course, raising gas prices would help their business model. So I guess that's part of it. But I would love to talk to you more about it later.
Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I've seen a lot of REOs in bank foreclosures out there. I've seen that they've taken pretty good care of their assets. I don't see where they're dilapidated. I don't see where they're run down. I see where they're hiring people to take care of the landscaping, and it's an asset. So they're going to take good care of it. The other thing I think we all need to keep in mind is that these local bankers, which I call in-state people, local bankers, they sell off most of their loans anyway, so they're not. They go to the secondary market. Most, I'd say probably 95% of all your loans end up in the secondary market, and maybe even more than that. So I think they do a you know, so therefore they aren't really involved in the Rios as much as, say, Chase or one of the large, Wells Fargo or one of the Bank of America. The other thing is, on the government regulations things that I didn't make it clear, I think it's fine that you have good regulation, but I think it's very, very irresponsible when you rush into something to regulate just to be regulating. That was my point. Now, obviously, some people didn't understand that, but that is the point. You can have a knee-jerk reaction, and that doesn't do anyone any good because you haven't asked the what if and what now question. So,
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really just had a comment to for Representative Cameron, and he slipped out, just addressing some of those bright spots in my district. I know there are some businesses that have acquired loans to expand their businesses, and the chair would be really happy to know that it's the microbrew industry and the wineries as well are seem to be growing, actually, and employing people and hiring people. So it may be just a little microcosm someplace, but I see a bright spot there. So thank you.
The two should never mix, but they're building electric cars down there too.
And that's quite true.
I think there's hope here, but it's just got to be. Yes, sir, Representative Witt.
Mr. Chairman, I just want Representative Holby to know that those stills can brew either brew or ethanol, and
right.
It's all good.
Amen.
Kind of solve our problems.
I'm with you. It all fires.
Hey, would you good people have any wrap-up comments you'd like? I really appreciate you coming here today. I really do. There's folks that have said, well, we need to make people come here and talk, and I was confident that this industry would be well represented if you were invited here to come and talk and answer any questions that were presented to you, and I really appreciate you following up on that. Any closing comments before we go?
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you. Yeah,
thank you. All right, any further questions of these good people? And they're not, they'll be back too if we want them back.
Are we open just for a comment?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to say one thing, that yesterday in Veterans, I told a story about a 14-year-old boy in our area that is making a drive to send 1,000 Christmas packages to our troops in Afghanistan. I do want to commend Representative Matthews for giving me $100 to give that kid to go towards that cause. The local banks, Premier West, the local credit unions have pitched in. Costco, Safeway, Gary West Foods, and Walmart have all pitched in to help this young man. And this young man's going to get his 1,000 boxes to Kandahar. And the real hang-up is $13,000 to get it there. It's $13 per package. But right now we're working with the General Caldwell here in the state of Oregon to see if we can't get a military transport to get that to Kandahar, and that way this young boy will be very successful. So
God bless him. We're all together. With that, I believe we are here.